This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alexandra Fuller told her story, the story of a chaotic childhood in colonial Africa, in her best-selling memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Largely set against the War for Independence, which transformed Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, the book was hailed as a love letter to Africa. But Alexandra considered the book a love letter to her mother, Nicola. And with her ever-present cocktail and gun, Nicola Fuller's larger-than-life presence stands out among the cast of already colorful characters. But Nicola did not love her daughter's depiction of her. In fact, she famously referred to Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight as that awful book, and she insisted that Alexandra really didn't understand who she is. So Alexandra set out to meet her mother. Through research and reporting, Alexandra Fuller tells the story of her mother, Nicola Fuller, in a new book, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. And Alexandra Fuller joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have been reading your mother's name, assuming it's Nicola.
Yes, that's correct.
So the pronunciation is right?
That's correct.
I probably could have asked you any time. But anyway, so if nothing else, your mother comes off as a pretty complicated lady in your memoir. What was your plan for meeting the challenge to get to understand her better?
It was in part accidental because my mother sort of considered that God had given her a pair of ovaries for one reason only, and that was to produce a biographer. So she set out to make a literary genius of my sister as a fetus, read the fetus the complete works of Shakespeare in the womb. My sister came out willfully illiterate as a result. And so my mother then fixed her not inconsiderable, sort of intentions on me and, sort of made it. I had to do school at home as a kindergartner because it was too dangerous to take us into town because the Bush War was at a point where there were so many landmines and ambushes and so on. So my mother would get this correspondence course from what was then Salisbury, now Harare, and she would just throw out the mathematics packet and say, darling, you can always pay someone to count for you, but you can never pay someone to be your voice. So I couldn't count. I had to be a writer. Right. And I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight really out of a place of frustration. I always knew I was going to be a writer, but I'd written 10 wildly unsuccessful novels. My agent fired me. My husband left to go and climb active volcanoes in Mexico, preference to being around a suicidal writer, so thoroughly rejected. But before he left, there was a note on his computer that said only to be opened in the event of my death. So I did wait till he got to the bottom of the driveway. And I ripped it open. And it was a very boring letter about insurance and mortgages and blah. But at the end of it, he said, I think you should just write the truth. And I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight really as a love letter for who I was, where I'd come from, because I was now living in the States. And I became very aware of the fact that my children wouldn't know who I was, that you become subsumed, really, by the majority culture around you. Cocktail Hour snuck up on me because after I'd written Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, my mother's main objection was, you never asked me who I am. And it was simply that. I asked her, who are you? And she told me, but I couldn't hear her. It took me a long time. It took me then another 8 years before I actually got whooping cough. And I was quite ill, lying in bed for 100 days with a mild fever. And I hauled the tapes down of this long interview I'd done with her. And it turns out that a mild fever was the precise temperature with which to remove that very judgmental label of daughter. And I could hear my mother, not as an accumulation of the ways that she had failed me as a mother or maybe perhaps come through as a mother, but as who she was, this complicated, glorious, impossible, wonderful woman.
It was interesting that you would say that because the reviews of your book, and I think the way I read it as well, the memoir, were that it wasn't judgmental in some ways. That a lot, clearly you can't come away not having an opinion about the characters you've written about, but that it wasn't judgmental. That you didn't sort of have to comment on every act in the book. But you felt that there was still a whole layer of filter and judgment that had to come away.
I think that, a decade is a long time in the middle of your life. And I think that the wonderful thing that happened in the interim between writing Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight and Cocktail Hour was that I wrote a couple of other books. So my idea of structure was stronger, my idea of arc, my idea of character. I was braver in Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, I think, but I think kinder in Cocktail Hour. And I think that that's an important attribute as we age. A very nice distinction, though, between being kinder and still yet being honest. And I think that there, it is, in a way, and you could argue with this, a form of compassion to be honest, that it is a way of truly seeing someone. And I don't think that we do enough of that. I don't think we see and acknowledge one another in all our raw, complicated, glorious selves.
Well, if you think about the processes that you brought to both books, I mean, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs is, I think, mostly coming out of memory, right? And that, then you apply this reportedly process to your latest book.
That's right, yeah.
And that's a different way of remembering, right? It's a different way of reporting. And
well, the world had changed so much in the 10 years since writing Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. When I was doing the research for Cocktail Hour, and by then I had done some actual real reporting, and so I had a more muscular ability in that regard. So I went back to sort of the places of my mother's youth and so on. But the research ability was so much wider. I could go back. For example, I remember the mortar attack in the boarding school that I was at. And I remember my sister being under mortar attack at the boarding school in the town that we lived in. But I could go on the internet and find an actual report of the mortar attack, how many mortars fell, the duration of the attack, the exact date, which is an amazing resource. I didn't have that 10 years ago.
But it's a different way of telling the truth, and it's a different kind of truth that you get, do you think? I mean, can I do that? Is it a different sort of truth when you do research and...
I'm not sure that I think what it did, what really surprised me was that if you follow a kind of honesty, for example, if you follow your gut feeling that the war had gotten really nasty by 1978, 1979, that something subversive was going on and was certainly being talked about by the 6 million black people and was talked about afterwards at boarding school where I was with majority black students. I was then able to go and find documents from the Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, documents by an American doctor, and work from two award-winning journalists who were able to confirm that, yes, biological and chemical warfare had been used in Rhodesia towards the end of the war. And what that did, it didn't change the sort of truth of the story, because I think that truthiness can interfere with the much larger emotional truth of a thing, that you can actually become distorted and deceptive using quote unquote facts. But what it did was it was able to shore up the certainty that yes, anthrax was planted in the tribal trust lands.
It makes it all the more difficult, it seems to me, to be kind, the word that you used, in a biography of people who were defending that very structure. Perhaps not all of the processes and not to the degree if they had known, but that's what they were defending, and those are your parents.
And I think one of the really interesting things that I've come at, and I think what one needs to remember, is that if you are writing a biography and you are in full command of more facts than the people of whom you are writing, that you write with that in mind. Now, one of the great things that I learned very young, and it was a wonderful lesson, is how effective propaganda is. And of course, the main ingredient of good propaganda is that you don't know that it is indeed propaganda. Otherwise, you know, are not baffled by it and you don't follow it. Under the Rhodesian War, we forget a time when information was impossible to get. We have now, in an age of Twitter and tweeting and internet and so on, information is available if we look for it almost everywhere. In Rhodesia, radio stations were silenced. Newspapers were censored. When Ian Smith made a unilateral declaration of independence for the first time in the newspaper's history, the Herald, the Rhodesian Herald, it had blank columns in its front page, where it continued with that throughout the war, where it would leave blank news that had been censored out. You become immune to the weather system of censorship. You don't realize the propaganda that you're being fed. And I don't think my parents even though they fought and defended this hideous regime, were aware of the full horror they were supporting. I don't think we ever are.
But when you, but part of this is not to have the information and not to know. But then, is there a degree to which we don't want to know? You've talked about the myth of ourselves, and as a memoirist, you know, I'm going to hold you accountable for that and what that means in terms of our own accountability in not knowing and not finding out what we can. But you've also said that this myth is in service to us, so that you're not ready to be utterly dismissive. It's not as though we're telling ourselves lies just to help us get to sleep.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that we, I think that very often what happens is we have a basic belief system, whatever it is. And for example, you may have uphold a belief system that we were justified in going to war in Iraq. And what then happens is the cost of that war becomes so high, becomes so real, becomes so apparent, that the only way you can sustain your belief is to allow for it to calcify into prejudice. And that's when it becomes problematic, I think, when we become so inflexible that our beliefs can't shift and change with evidence, and we don't look rigorously for more information, and we don't allow ourselves the flexibility of information, which is why hard news, good reporting remains so important, and why it is such a tragedy that the time that we really need it in this country, it disappeared from the mainstream.
Talk more about the book, because if you said your mother made it her duty to bear a biographer, it seems your father was just the opposite. He didn't care to reflect at all and really didn't like this process very much, although he cooperated with it. Tell us more about your father.
Well, he's taciturn to the extreme. He is, I mean, in a way, an anecdote sort of sums up the whole three remaining family members that I have, which was that the year that my father turned 69, he declared this is it, last year on earth, because when he turned 70, that's it. He's done his 3 score year and 10, and now he's going to die. And so we all had to troop out into the middle of the farm. They live in the middle Zambezi Valley. It's incredibly hot, to find the tree that he wanted to be buried under. He found a big baobab tree. And then my mother, never one to miss out on any drama, chose the tree she wanted to be buried under. My father considered it was a bit close to his tree. And so he moved his tree sort of 250 yards south of her tree. And this could have carried on. My sister and I could see very quickly this could carry on indefinitely. So we lured them back to the Tree of Forgetfulness, where they've built a shack, is actually a strong word for what they have. They have a sort of structure with a roof that they live under. And you know, had a few drinks. And then we began to talk about my father's funeral, as one does. And my sister, Vanessa, the functionally, willfully illiterate one, said to me, "Oh my gosh, Bobo, I can't stand it. When Dad dies, you're going to have to do the urology." And I think that sort of covers the family. And my dad, really, his sort of take on me being a writer is that it violates his greatest principle, which is if you don't have anything nice to say about anyone, don't say anything at all. The resounding upshot of which he is incredibly silent on the subject of his own family. I really had to dig around and sort of press him to talk about that. And I didn't realize how deeply wounded he was by the way in which his family so strongly objected to him coming out to Kenya, so strongly objected to his marriage to this wild, beautiful colonial woman, my mother, that they cut him out of not just their will and whatever that meant, but of their emotional lives, and how that really affected all of us, that at a time when we were really quite poor, in the middle of a very brutal war, and a helping hand from family probably would have helped, and may have in fact helped save the life of my brother, it didn't come.
You've talked about that and other aspects of internalization, how we internalize these wounds, and particularly when you write about war and people who come back from war and how war turns in on itself, how the violence becomes domestic very quickly, and in internalizing that radiates out long beyond the last truce.
War, I have said, is not the fault of soldiers, but it becomes their life's burden. And the thing about civil war, I mean, the way I think the U.S. has fought its most recent wars is to outsource them in every way, not just the soldiers, but we outsource the security and we take the fight off our own soil. And I think that we, perhaps not so much here in North Carolina and Georgia and Wyoming and places where we have a strong troop contingent, mm-hmm. but we tend to forget for much of the country that we're even at war. My experience of a civil war, which I think has stayed with me forever, is the way in which war does not stay in the places that our government tells us it'll stay. It doesn't stay in front lines. There's no such thing. It spills over. It becomes, it doesn't just stop at the front door. It moves into our kitchens and our bedrooms. By the end of the civil war in Rhodesia, all men between the ages of 18 and 60, all white men between the ages of 18 and 60, which therefore included my father, were conscripted to fight for 6 months of the year. So my father was gone half the year. But when I say gone, he walked down, the war began at our front door. He walked down the bottom of our driveway and was taken off in an army vehicle to the hills behind our house. And that's where he was fighting insurgents and freedom fighters. And the man that returned from those increasingly difficult skirmishes was exhausted, more and more taciturn. And I think one of the things that we don't realize is that if you're going to create a soldier, you are in danger of losing a father, a husband, a brother, and not just his life.
And you talked about the way sexual trauma, if for a woman, experiences sexual trauma, and you can't even report this because of the sort of structural belief that these guys were off doing the right thing and you're about to destroy their life if you're going to name names.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that in war, it becomes the great shame. I think that there's a kind of, certainly the war that I experienced, there's a version of survivor's guilt that happens when you're a woman and you're raised from a very, very early age. I mean, my parents had given both my sister and I a gun and taught us how to shoot to kill. It was an Uzi submachine gun. And my father took a brick out of the wall of our farmhouse so that I could put the entire weight of my body against the end of the Uzi so that when I pulled the trigger, it didn't send me flying across the room. In the event that they were, in the actually increasingly likely event that they were killed during an ambush or an attack on the house, my sister and I would then be able to have a fighting chance to defend ourselves. So I understood and was made very aware of what killing was, of what wounding was. My father taught me the difference between shooting to kill, shooting to maim, shooting to hurt. Now, when we went away to boarding school, the boys were treated very different from the girls. They were treated absolutely brutally. They were thrown, you know, boiling buckets of boiling water and then freezing cold water on them. They were woken at dawn and sort of sent on these runs around the school grounds and bare feet. And they were, it was largely unspoken but well understood that when these boys were 16, they better be ready to go out into very harsh conditions and kill, be prepared to kill for this country. Now, as girls, we didn't have that. As girls, the message, the implied message was, and we would be home watching the hearth and sort of supporting this. And so you get this early version of what, like I say, survivor's guilt, where you think, but just for my gender, go I.
And so that anything that you would do in support of them would be your compensation.
Right. And so the way in which women accepted the kind of violence that these men would bring home domestically was very interesting. And the way that we were also invested in their purity and goodness and that they were fighting for God and country became very important. So if they went away and committed atrocities, we didn't want to know about it. And my second book, Scribbling the Cat, which is the book I think that you're referring to, it the anger that book generated, in part because I think this is a very uncomfortable truth. If you are going to start a war, atrocities will be committed. You can't give a young 18-year-old male, female, whomever, a gun, and remove that most basic of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, without thinking that other commandments will also fall by the wayside.
I'm talking with Alexandra Fuller, author of the new book, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Our conversation continues in a moment on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking with Alexandra Fuller, author of the best-selling memoir Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Her new book is called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. You endured trauma as a young child. Your sister did as well. You witnessed the death of siblings, endured sexual trauma. Your sister Vanessa, you've already talked about her, are very different. Do you think you have different coping mechanisms?
Wow, what a very American question. I believe in some way that writers are born and then they make themselves on top of that. And so from a very early age, I mean, joking about my mother leaving me no choice aside, which is only really a semi-joke, I think that the warm bath of all that literature that she sort of submerged me in certainly didn't hurt the way that I evolved as a writer. But I do remember from a very, very early age, and some of this also might be the fact that I'm not the oldest. My sister was the oldest. There was a brother between us and then me, and then there were two younger siblings. And my sister and I remained. I think she took a lot of the heat of the war, the violence of the war. She stood in protection as a shield between me and a lot of the world, which I wasn't always aware of. So I think there was that. But also there was the fact that from a very early age, I was something of a voyeur. I have a very distinct memory of being quite young and standing on the outside of things. And these sorts of alarms going off in my head going, everything is not okay. And of course, around us, the way that I think we as humans tend to cope with stressful situations is to act as if everything's just fine. And this loud voice, sometimes in the back, front of my head, little in the back, saying, not okay, not okay, not okay, and taking notes all the time. And mental notes. And I wasn't sort of keeping a diary or anything Victorian like that. And I think I wrote and explored and thought my way into and out of situations. And I think that becomes a way of deflection. Whereas I think my older sister absorbed the blows. And that, in a way, is a much more permanently damaging thing to have happened. And I think that she has had a harder time as an adult coming to terms with childhoods, which I basically experienced as very happy. She didn't.
Do you, first of all, I'd like to know what you meant by that, a very American question. What does that mean?
Well, my mother, when I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, tried to, which was so embarrassed and mortified that a child of hers would have done this. So the first thing that she told everyone was that I must have been switched at birth. No child of hers would have done this. Unfortunately, I looked just like her, so that sort of fell a bit flat. So then she tried to say, well, you know, she's my American daughter now. And Americans like to write memoirs about how they're not hugged enough. And then they go on the Oprah Springer show or whatever it's called, and they sob. And so it's this kind of what we as Brits, but particularly colonial British, would consider an over... A sort of analysis of one's past as if that bore some kind of pertinence on one's presence and one's future. Now, the fact the way I was raised, it is considered, I think one drama follows so hot foot on the last that one doesn't really have time to sit back and reflect.
But you do have a certain amount of detachment. I guess that was what's behind it. This idea, to what extent does coping with trauma give you the detachment? In other words, would you have been the writer you are had you not gone through those things? I suppose it's impossible to ask that. The answer is always no. Nobody's who, you know, you wouldn't be who you are. But did it give you, as a coping mechanism, does it give you what a writer needs?
Well, I tell you one thing that I got from my childhood, I think, is a very high emotional metabolism. I am able to fully and completely and very quickly absorb and process emotion and a very wide spectrum of emotion. We were talking in the break a little bit about emotion and this idea growing up, it became very clear to me that my father had about three emotions. They were anger, happiness, and there may be one other, but that sort of was it. Whereas my mother had this sort of rainbow of emotions. And I remember observing that and finding that very interesting. And in war, one's culture becomes very male. It's just as war is a very male construct and a male idea. Even if women get sucked into fighting the war, as my mother did. And so we were in a very male culture where it wasn't okay to show emotions other than happiness and anger. Anger was fine. You could be as angry as you liked. War tends to make people angry. But now I'm in the awkward position of being a young female and then let alone a female adolescence where you've got this raw kind of spectrum of emotions. So I became very adept at processing them quickly and deeply. So I am a fabulous sobber, but I can shut a door, have a quick breakdown for 5 minutes, get over whatever it is. I mean, I didn't get over is even the right word, but I think process whatever it is. And then I think a certain degree of that quite British impatience of, look, you've got to pull up your socks and get on with it, not hang on to one's past as an excuse for not being present in one's presence.
Your book, Scribbling the Cat, is the book that deals directly with the civil war in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. And you tell us about the subject of that book, Kay. What attracted you to him?
Well, what was really interesting was that after the war was over and I was 11, I was at a boarding school with, for the first time, majority black students. Until that time, schools had been segregated. And they were boarding schools, so you were incredibly segregated. You weren't just sort of segregated in an ordinary sense. All your teachers were white, your matrons were white, all the other students were white. And now suddenly the war ended and boom, overnight, the majority of the students in my school were black, some of whom, many of whom, had actually fought in the war because they had been involved as messengers and child soldiers to some degree. And it had a very different experience of the war than I had. And what I loved about that was that it made me process the way the war had happened in a very different way, because one of the things about being on the losing side of a war is that it now doesn't get spoken about. It was a forbidden subject in our family. War was over. That was it. We'd lost as far as we were concerned. So now there's this awful silence on this thing, this major thing that has had huge impact, not just on our lives, but as far as I could tell, on the lives of everyone around us. There was a rash of suicides after the war. There was a lot of madness. There was an incredibly high incidence of what you would call alcoholism, which we just call someone's got a slightly loose elbow. And my father went silent for about 20 years after the war and put down his guns. Even in a very violent situation, he said, I would rather be shot. I have spilt enough blood. But beyond that, he would not speak. And then I found this character, Kay, who spoke about the war almost compulsively. And he was an incredibly powerful man. He was in his early 50s when I met him. The war had been over longer than 20 years at that point. And he had been in the Rhodesian Light Infantry, which was an all-white unit. A lot of the, most of the other units were segregated, did not segregate whites out from blacks. Blacks were also recruited to fight for the Rhodesians. They were paid. And as a member of the RLI, the sort of crack unit, they had the highest kill ratio of any unit in the Rhodesian army. They were considered the most brutal, them and the Sulu scouts. And here was this man who was prepared to talk about his war. I thought perhaps I would find the reason for some of the cracks in me if I found out what his story was. Because the one thing that I think we forget about when we create a war is that we don't intend for children to be its victims, but they will absorb the violence. They will absorb the lessons of the war. You can't separate out women and children from war, particularly not civil war or war on the ground. I mean, women and children in Afghanistan and Iraq are not exempt from our violence, even if that's our intention. And so I thought perhaps that would be an answer, really, to a lot of these sort of uneasinesses that I had kept with me, even now living in the States.
Well, what do you mean the cracks in you? What were you sensing about? Because you said you're somebody who processes very quickly, you get over it, you move on, and yet you still felt there were unresolved
Well,
questions.
You know, I think that there's a order of monks that say, give me a child until he's seven and then he's mine for life. Given that I had been under the sort of propaganda and the Rhodesian regime, I wondered what lessons I had absorbed unconsciously and had probably processed very well, knowing me, and that what I wasn't aware of.
What did you learn?
Not what I was expecting. For one thing, I suppose I rather fondly imagined that being with the soldier and really exploring what he had gone through would somehow set something to rest in me. In actual fact, it stirred up a sort of hornet's nest of questions. And I think the conclusion that I came away with was what Plato said, only the dead have seen the end of war. That, in other words, you can create war, but you can't stop it. It's not a video game. You can't rewind it. It will go on spooling on and on and on forever and ever until you forget even the cause of that war. And all that has remained, I think, is the sort of distillation of the violence.
It's spellbinding violence, isn't it? It casts a spell, do you think? We seem not to be able to, because the damage it does should be so obvious that we would probably stay away from war forever if we weren't somehow beguiled and under some kind of a spell.
I think that one of the really interesting things when I was speaking to these soldiers, especially the soldiers that had been in a crack unit, and actually even speaking to my mother, who's a little more circumspect about it, war brings you to that brink of life and death. And so it becomes addictive in a way because you can't be anywhere else. Now, in order to get there in our day-to-day lives, it's much harder work. We probably have to meditate or truly clear our minds of clutter to understand to get to that true sort of sense of exaltation that you hear soldiers talk about or sometimes extreme athletes speak about. And so we become addicted to Twitter and Facebook and all the other ways that we have of not being where we are.
You have you're now living in Wyoming.
Yes.
And you've written about that and about what the oil industry is doing to us. Your third book is called The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. Who was he? Tell us about Colton H. Bryant.
I began to do a story for a magazine on what happens to a small cowboy community when natural gas, a way of extracting natural gas, is discovered, in this case hydrofracking. And the town went from a sort of sleepy cowboy town to one of the largest natural gas fields in the United States. And it had been protected federal land, which was this very sort of sacred space for big game animals coming out of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Overnight, it was turned into an industrial field of compressor stations and well sites and so on and roads and you know, animals were getting killed on the roads all the time. In some cases, scores of animals by a single oil truck. Water was being contaminated. Air quality dropped. But all of this is very difficult to talk about in Wyoming. There's a real impatience for it. I mean, after all this overriding conversation that we have about jobs, and back when the boom first started, the war had just begun in Iraq, and so the conversation was about energy independence and other ways that we fool ourselves into thinking that we need to do this to ourselves, and we're not having the conversation we need to have, which is about alternative energy. Out of the corner of my eye, while I was researching this magazine story, one of the things that sort of kept cropping up was death on the rigs, and wasn't widely reported. Sometime in 2006, though, the fourth roughneck in 6 months on one tiny small oil patch fell to his death from an icy rig on February 14th, Valentine's Day. And what made me pay attention was that the company responsible for killing him, the CEO of that company, in the same newspaper, was boasting about, yet again, fifth quarter of record-breaking profits. The injustice disgusted me. I then managed to find out through an investigative reporter who had done work on this that the fine The average fine was somewhere between $200 and very, very outset, $10,000. The fine the company got for killing Colton was $6,000. The drilling company was fined $6,000. Oil companies in Wyoming exempt from any kind of responsibility if a worker is maimed or killed on the rigs. You get fined more for killing a moose out of season in Wyoming than you do for killing a roughneck. And we have the highest, amongst the highest death rate in the nation, or the highest death rate in the nation over a period of 10 years. We kill roughly 86 workers per 100,000. The national average is something like 4.4. And part of this is the way in which we've lifted regulations so that oil companies can come in here and drill natural gas. We haven't just lifted regulations on air and water and land and wildlife, but on human life itself. And I thought, if we can't in Wyoming have the conversation about the environment, which had been something that I cared about very deeply, at least let's have the conversation about being our brother's keeper. But if I tell statistics to Wyomingites, they're going to shrug it off. But if I tell the story of one boy, perhaps that will make us wake up a little bit.
I wish we had more time to extend this conversation, Alexandra, but I don't. Thank you so much. What a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Fuller's new book is called Cocktail Hour: Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. And that is our program for today. Alexandra is going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music tonight, right? Signing books and talking with you. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll find out about it. Go to Quail Ridge. Go to our website. You'll find all the details. And the new book is called Cocktail Hour: Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Our program is called The State of Things, which you can find at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.